When I was at university, in the Jewish society, there was a controversy when there was somebody who was an active member of the Jewish community, and they had been leading services and participating fully in the Jewish community for a year, a couple of years. They were a young 20-year-old student. And at a certain point, they started telling everyone in the community that they were an atheist. They were like, it was not just something that they sort of revealed, but it was something they were excited about telling. It was something that they'd gone on this journey of spiritual discovery and realized that they felt that they were an atheist. But that didn't do anything for them in terms of their desire to participate in the Jewish community and to keep leading services. And there were some people in the community who felt that it was completely inappropriate for somebody who didn't believe in God to be standing up as a representative of the community to be leading the community in the community's prayer to God. And there were some people in the community who felt very strongly, for a number of different reasons, that we should not be pushing this person out of the community, and we should be enabling them to participate fully in the community, despite this newfound atheism that they were sharing with everyone. That is the story. Okay, I now want to do a poll to see where people in the room's sympathies lie. I'm going to ask if people feel more sympathetic to the people who felt uncomfortable with this person leading services, or whether people feel more sympathetic towards the people in the community who were not so perturbed by this person's discovery of atheism and actually wanted to enable this person to participate in the community. So, group one, he should not have been allowed to lead services. Okay, good. And now the other side, people who feel more sympathetic to the people who wanted to allow participation. Okay, I would say it looks like about two-thirds. People generally feel like they want to allow this person to lead the service. Okay, so somebody who was in the group of people who thought that this person shouldn't have been allowed to lead the service, come and be a representative. Yes, please.
So the Shliach Tzibur has the job of leading the community, and he has to be sincere, and he has to be bringing along the community behind him. The people who are davening are relying on the Shliach Tzibur to bring them on, that they should be able to grab his coattails, so to speak. So a person who's openly saying, I no longer believe in God, he's standing up there and he's lying. But I would at the same time say this person should still come to every Shabbos dinner and every...
That's the nuance, yeah.
I stood up.
Yeah, it's true.
And so that's my opinion. You don't exclude him from the community, but you don't put him in that leadership position either.
Okay, amazing. There's something particular about the role of being a Shliach Tzibur that actually just doesn't make sense to have somebody who doesn't believe in God, but that shouldn't necessarily mean that that person shouldn't be able to participate in the community, is what you're saying. Okay, somebody from the other side.
There's always the possibility that a person who perceives himself or herself as an atheist at a given moment can be persuaded emotionally, persuaded is the wrong word,
yeah.
to have a different perception through the experience of leading the service. So I think the dilemma is, does the community want to take a chance on making this person more part of the community, or does the community feel that they don't want a representative who doesn't feel like they do at the country?
Great. I heard two points there, which were both, I think, very astute points. The first point that I heard you make was that beliefs are actually dynamic and people can change their beliefs and be persuaded and move in the kinds of beliefs that they have. And giving this person the opportunity to lead the service might actually be an opportunity for growth in terms of belief. But also the other thing that I heard you say there was actually the question, it's not a simple question of who is going to be the Shliach Tzibur and who isn't going to be the Shliach Tzibur. There's something more at stake in the question, which is actually has to do with who we are able to hold in the community and who we push away from the community. Okay, that was great. Let's take one more comment up there at the back.
I have one problem with deciding who to wavering, who to wavering. from the point of very persuasive, but to me the thing that pushed me towards not allowing him to be a Shalev Tzibor had almost nothing to do with the fact that he considered himself an atheist, and everything to do with the fact that he was proudly waving in front of everyone else.
Good. Everyone, the 3 points that we've just heard, in a way, we don't really need to go on and read these sources. We will do anyway, because we've got half an hour to fill. That's another super astute point, which is, it might not be that we want to police people's beliefs, but there's something actually disruptive about the way in which this person was behaving, and it was like an affront, and it almost like sort of made light of the process or the experience of communal davening, to have somebody who was sort of proudly proclaiming themselves as an atheist, to have that kind of person leading the davening. There's an emptiness to the words that they're saying, and that's troubling as somebody who's leading the community. The questions of who we can and can't pray with can be a source of immense tension in communities made up of people with diverse sets of practices and beliefs. There's questions about who we're willing to embrace in our communities and what kind of communities we're willing to enter and to participate in. And those questions are often turn on questions about like how similar we need to be in practice to the people with whom we're entering into community, but they also turn potentially on questions of like how similar we need to be in beliefs with people in order to enter into community with them. And those dynamics turn up in all kinds of halachic questions about davening. So questions like who can be appointed as a shalich tzibor, who can be appointed as a leader of davening, who we can count in a minyan, who we can give an aliyah to the Torah. I'm going to focus, this source sheet in particular, focuses on the question of whose bracha we can answer amen to. Who's, when someone makes a blessing, what kind of person do they have to be in order for us to be able to answer amen to their bracha? That question is, I think, a helpful question for a couple of reasons. First of all, there's a way in which it's more fundamental than the other questions. The question of who we can appoint as a shalich tzibor can only get off the ground if we know that we can answer amen to their bracha. The question of who we can give an aliyah to the Torah turns on the question of whether we can answer amen to their bracha. If we can't answer amen to their brachot, then it's no use appointing them to those positions. But also, there is something so raw and emotional about the willingness or unwillingness to respond amen to someone's bracha. When we answer amen to someone's bracha, we're telegraphing to ourselves and to the people around us and to the people who make a kind of affinity and willingness to be in relationship, willingness to be in a kind of religious relationship with those people. But the corollary, and also we show affirmation and respect for those people. But the corollary of that is that the refusal to say amen to someone's bracha can feel extremely charged. I'm sure I've had experiences being in synagogues that are ideologically different from, I mean, there's a lot of ideological diversity in terms of different communities that people are part of. And it's interesting when you go into a synagogue where there are different kinds of people praying together to notice who feels nervous about answering amen. And who is more willing to answer amen to those brachot. So those are two reasons why I think this question of who you can answer amen to is actually a really important and valuable question. So I want to present two models for how to think about this question. The first model is, in some ways, the most intuitive model. The first model, which is this first page of the source sheet, centers beliefs. It says that rituals emerge out of beliefs. This is from Rambam's Mishneh Torah. He says that it is forbidden to burn holy scriptures. To what case does that refer? To holy scriptures that were written by a Jew in holiness. But if a heretical Jew wrote a Sefer Torah, we burn it with all of the names of God in it, because they do not believe in the holiness of God and did not write it with God in mind, but rather they consider it just like any other words. Okay? Rav Moshe Feinstein, as far as I can tell, is the first person to explicitly articulate a vision of communal prayer that is based on that kind of way of thinking. He's a 19th and 20th century United States-based rabbi. And he says the following. We see from the Rambam that one who doesn't believe in the holiness of God, when they write holy scriptures, the letters of God's name are just like any other words. And if so, it is obvious that when they say God's name, it is also like arbitrary words. And one should not regard it as a bracha, since it is like a bracha that makes no mention of God. And it is also like there is no mention of God's kingship, because they don't regard God as king of the world, but just say this to pad out their words. So this articulation is similar to some of the things that we were hearing at the beginning. There's a way in which people who don't believe in God, there's a certain emptiness to the words of their prayer. And it's from a perspective that centers belief, it's actually hard to understand what would make sense of being in a kind of prayerful or religious kind of mode, operating with that kind of person. This kind of way of thinking about it is centers belief. And Rav Moshe Feinstein here is talking about belief in God. But there are all kinds of aspects of our prayer and beyond when we're building communities together where we can imagine people getting together and imagining their communities as being grounded in some kind of shared vision and some kind of shared goal. So our prayers talk about God, but they also talk about justice. How similar does your picture, your conception of justice need to be to somebody else's in order to be able to pray words that focus on justice together? How similar do your views about redemption need to be able to pray with people about what a redeemed world is like? Okay, so that is the first model. It is a powerful basis for building a certain kind of community. It is a powerful basis for building an ideological community. If everyone can get together and sign on to a set of beliefs, then this is a great model. It's like rituals emerge. It's super intuitive. We have a set of beliefs, and what are rituals for? Rituals are to inculcate those beliefs and for us to rehearse those beliefs and to celebrate those beliefs as a community. Okay, that's the first model. There are a bunch of problems with that model, some of which were alluded to in the initial points, but I just want to spell some of these problems out. There is a problem with this model because it focuses on beliefs. Why is that a problem? Because beliefs are complex and beliefs are dynamic. There are disagreements within the tradition and disagreements within our communities about what we have to believe in. There are disagreements, even if people can agree about the terms of things that we have to agree about within our community, people can have different conceptions of but how those beliefs should manifest. People can maybe agree that God exists, but people could have different conceptions of what it means for God to exist. People can agree that prayer is about being in relationship with God in a certain way, but people can have radical disagreements about what that actually looks like. There are also psychological problems. Personally, when I think about my own beliefs, my beliefs are not something that I could easily articulate. I have beliefs about my beliefs. I can self-psychoanalyze to try to understand where my beliefs come from and where my beliefs emerge from. And I can also look at my sociological context and the context in which I was raised to try to understand where my beliefs come from. I can look at my own insecurities and try to examine why I believe the particular things that I believe. And all of that amounts to a kind of destabilization of beliefs, not to mention the fact that sometimes we don't know what we believe. We're unsure of the things that we believe. And we can, our beliefs can change over time. And sometimes we can even reflect on beliefs that we've had in the past and notice that those beliefs weren't actually our beliefs. We just had them for a particular kind of reason. That's a bunch of reasons. Like I could go on. There are other ways in which beliefs are super complex. But that is a way in which beliefs are a very challenging basis for any kind of communal building, particularly around prayer, because beliefs just aren't stable. There's an academic, a religious anthropologist called Catherine Bell, who summarizes this problem very well. She says the study of ritual has always assumed the close association of rite with belief. Ritual has generally been thought to express beliefs in symbolic ways for the purposes of their continual reaffirmation and inculcation. The traditional association of belief and ritual is challenged by growing evidence that most symbolic action, even the basic symbols of a community's ritual life, can be very unclear to participants or interpreted by them in very dissimilar ways. Yet, despite the different cultural interpretations attached to them, such symbols still promote social solidarity. This suggests that some level or degree of social consensus does not depend upon shared information or beliefs, and ritual need not be seen as a simple medium of communicating such information or beliefs. Indeed, ritual forms are useful because they rarely make any interpretation explicit. That is, they focus on common symbols, not on statements of beliefs. Okay, so Catherine Bell's research actually emerges from a bunch of studies that were done where people, religious anthropologists, would turn up, for example, at a church service on a Sunday morning, and they would interview people coming out of the communion, and they would be like, what just happened there? Like, what was that for you? And there was an extremely wide range of people's of descriptions as to what was going on for people in those different in that experience of the communion, even though it was able to bring together all of those people together to feel actually that they were together in some kind of community and invested in some kind of shared project. So given that background of the kind of impossibility and also just social reality of beliefs not being the center of the way in which people build rituals and build their communities of prayer, is there another model within our tradition that can actually help us to understand what's going on in prayer in a different way? So we're turning now to centering form, which is an alternative model. We're going to start with a Mishnah. The Mishnah talks about Kutim, or Samaritans. There's a whole interesting history of the relationship between Jews and Samaritans. The key thing to understand here is that Samaritans were a kind of in-between group. They were a bit like Jews, but a bit not like Jews. They had some beliefs that were similar to Jews, and they had some beliefs that were kind of different from Jews. And so the rabbis of the Talmud were nervous about them. Okay, they wanted to be in community with them in certain ways, and they thought that they were part of some kind of shared project in certain ways, but in other ways they were very nervous of them. Onin amen achar Yisrael hamavarech. One should answer amen after a Jew who makes a bracha. Ve'ein onin amen achar hakuti hamavarech ad sheishma et kol habracha. But one should not answer amen after a Samaritan who makes a bracha until one has heard the entire bracha. Three things I want to point out about this Mishnah. There's two halves to the Mishnah. One talks about the rule of answering amen to a Jew, and one talks about the rule of answering amen to a Samaritan. In the second half of the Mishnah, you are not allowed to answer amen to the Samaritan until you've heard the entire bracha. That implies that that condition is absent from the first half of the first half of the Mishnah. You answer amen to the bracha of a Jew regardless of whether you have heard the entire bracha. This implies that minimally you are permitted to, or maximally expected to answer amen in that way. And that seems to have to do with an insight to do with community building. To be in community with people, you actually have to sacrifice a degree of autonomy. You have to be able to trust people. You have to show some level of trust to being able to be in community with them in a deep way. You can't be policing everyone's behavior. Otherwise, that kind of implies a hierarchy in terms of your relationships, and that's not a meaningful community. It's a meaningful community to be able to hear part of someone's bracha and say, that's good enough for me. I'm happy to answer amen to that bracha, and I'm going to be vulnerable to the possibility that that person was doing something not exactly the way that I would have wanted them to do it. Okay, that's the first half of the Mishnah. The second half of the Mishnah is about the Samaritan. The Samaritan, you see here in full force, the suspicion of the rabbis around the Samaritans. They are nervous that the Samaritan is going to do something disruptive. It's going to change the formulation of the bracha and actually express something that would be undermining to what we're trying to do as a community, or undermining to the way that we do things as a community. But nonetheless, the Mishnah says, if you hear the entire bracha, and they say it in the correct way, then you answer amen. You answer amen to that bracha. So why is that? So the Rosh, who was a 13th, 14th century German and then moved to Spain commentator, he offers an explanation. He says, "Im shama kol habracha, muchach milta she'in kavanato la'avodah zarah." If you heard the entire bracha, that proves that the intent was not to idol worship. Okay, we were nervous that they were going to say something that was kind of idolatrous, but if you heard the entire bracha, that proves that they didn't have problematic intent. The problem with that comment of the Rosh is it makes no sense at all. Okay? If there's one thing that we know about the Samaritans, it's that they have problematic intent. We know that they have all kinds of weird ways of thinking about stuff. We know that we don't agree with them. We know that we don't agree where the worship is centered. They don't center it in Jerusalem. They center it in Har Gerizim. They have all kinds of problematic beliefs. And the Rosh says, the Rosh assumes that the words that they say are directly correlated with their intent, which makes no sense at all. So it actually seems like the Rosh is making a kind of ideological point here. The Rosh is saying that if we hear them make the entire bracha, then we are committed to seeing their behavior in the best possible light. We're committed to being able to be in a kind of religious relationship with them, and we're committed to ignoring the possibility that they have problematic intent. And that is, in fact, how Rav Yitzchak Shvadron, who was living in Galicia in the 19th century, he wrote a commentary on the Tosefta, and he comments on the Rosh as follows. He says, when one hears the entire bracha, one answers amen, since it has been proven that the Samaritan's intention was only to God, since he said the entire bracha. That so far is just the same as the Rosh. And then he adds, and also then we pay no attention to what is in his heart. Okay? You ignore what might be going on in somebody else's heart. The Rosh's insight is very profound here. He notices the power of fixed liturgy as a tool in community building. By maximizing uniformity, by getting everyone to say the same thing, it allows for total anonymity, okay? It allows Kutim, it allows Samaritans to be able to participate in the community. And that actually, to me, speaks powerfully to some of the points that I was making before about the complicated nature of beliefs. Beliefs are dynamic. People change their beliefs all the time. People grow in their beliefs. People are self-reflective about their beliefs. And the notion that we could build a community where we policed beliefs is untenable. Imagine if we asked people every time they came to shul, as an admission policy for a shul, to sign on to, I don't know, Rambam's 13 principles of faith, or some other set of ideologies. Nobody would show up. Nobody would turn up to shul. Or that activity of signing on to those beliefs would become a ritual, which was quickly emptied of meaning. But actually, fixing a liturgy, having a fixed liturgy, is an amazing tool through which, and a vessel through which people can grow in their beliefs and in their relationship with their ideas and with God. Both of these models have their limits. People need to feel integrity with the words they are saying. So that is a big challenge taken to the extreme. This second model that I've been presenting is a real challenge. People do, by and large, need to feel some degree of integrity with what they're saying. It's hard to show up to a synagogue and participate in a liturgical service if you have no level of identification with the words that are being said, with the words that are being said in the prayers. So, for example, in 1967, there was a big controversy in Israel about what we're going to do about the Nachem prayer on Tisha B'Av. There's a prayer that we say on Tisha B'Av. We'd said for hundreds and hundreds of years that articulated how sad it was that Jerusalem had been taken over and we were no longer the inhabitants in Jerusalem and Jerusalem was destroyed. After 1967, Jews returned to having a level of sovereignty in Jerusalem, and there was a big controversy that broke out. There were chief rabbis of Israel who said, we need to change this prayer. It makes no sense for us to say a prayer that is articulating our loss of Jerusalem anymore and how we want to pray for the return of Jews to Jerusalem. There were other significant halachic figures, on the other hand, who pushed strongly against any kind of liturgical change. They articulated things like, well, the Beit HaMikdash still hasn't been built, so we haven't really returned to Jerusalem. But what actually strikes me as potentially going on in some of the more conservative voices in that debate is they noticed the way what was being articulated by the Mishnah, what was being articulated by the Rosh, that actually there is such a power to fixity in liturgy. There's such a power to having a liturgy that everyone has got on board, that people over hundreds of years have got on board with this liturgy, and any kind of destabilization of that liturgy is a potential force in the splintering of the Jewish people. So as it happens, the Jewish people now is splintered on the question of what to say, and people have written new versions of that prayer in light of the modern reality in Jerusalem. Centering beliefs is also limited in all the ways that I described. People's beliefs are dynamic, and people's beliefs change over time. But yes, as I said again, centering beliefs gives a lot more flexibility for changing the forms. So people who wanted to get behind a Zionist vision of what was taking place in Jerusalem were much more able and to fully embrace that and to disregard elements of the Jewish people who were not behind that vision, were very able to get behind a shift in that liturgy. On the other hand, a certain level of rigidity in the form paradoxically allows people with a wide-ranging and dynamic beliefs to be able to join together in community. Okay, I've been presenting two different models here, one that centers beliefs on the one hand, and one that centers form on the other hand. But to speak personally for a second, I find this second model. This second model is something I just discovered a few months ago. I was flicking through the Tosefta, as you do, and saw this comment of Rav Yitzchak Shvadron, where he says, we pay no attention to what's going on. Ein mashrichin az lemasha belibo. We pay no attention to what's going on in the Samaritan's heart. And that struck me as a very, very powerful model for community building. In a world in which communities are splintering, even in the modern world outside of the Jewish community, ideologies are very powerful and draw communities together. But actually, those people can pit ideologies and ideas and beliefs against each other in a way that can be very splintering and very divisive. And this model is a powerful model for community building and a powerful model for imagining ways in which we can actually have structures and rituals and all kinds of things that we do together that don't have to necessarily be based on belief, but can actually get some of the benefits of what it is to be part of a community and be part of a group of people who look out for each other by dint of being part of that community. So the Mishnah and the Rosh and the Minchat Yitzchak ask us to pay attention to when someone is being genuinely disruptive, as is the case of the Samaritan, but to consider also when we can say, Ein mashkichin b'masha b'libo. We don't pay attention to what is going on in that person's heart.